previously.tvpodcastnetwork.
I've done this for a long time, and this is the most far-fetched story I've ever heard, and it's not going to help you.
It's been 10 years since the murder of Travis Alexander and almost 30 since the murder of Rebecca Schaefer. Has anything changed in law enforcement in the intervening time? And are an American murder mystery and the deadliest decade worth your time? I've convened my own Brat Pack for The Blotter Presents, episode 41. That reference will make sense. I am joined once again by the decidedly unbratty Kevin Smokler. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on the show and discussing a case that I feel like was, when I first started The Blotter, the original site, which you can find at the-blotter.com, I had a freelancer who just pitched me constantly on Jodi Arias stuff, and I just took the pitches because it was like that was the only crime in America at the time. So even though this actually aired last week, Jodi Arias, An American Murder Mystery on Investigation Discovery, is our most wanted. Because I feel like I really didn't know that much about the case, even as it was happening. Like, it just wasn't something that was on my radar, except for editing these pieces. I will link to all of the Blotter's coverage in our show notes. But first, let's open the case file. On June 9th, 2008, Travis Alexander's decomposing body was discovered in his shower by friends. It didn't take police too long to narrow the suspect pool down to a single person, Travis's ex with benefits, Jodi Arias. The resulting investigation and trial preoccupied the nation, probably because Arias acted so off, and definitely because this culture loves a good cathartic court slut shame.
Oh my, yes.
But is it really an American murder mystery? Investigation Discovery tried to find out over three nights, and Kevin and I have some questions of our own. But I will start with a question for you, Kevin. How familiar were you with this case before we plunged headlong into all the horrifying details?
Not at all. And I don't say that as a way of being sort of self-righteously misinformed, you know, the way people say, oh, I don't know anything about Justin Bieber.
I don't have a TV. Yeah. Like, OK, yeah, not that kind of uninformed.
No, I think that has less to do with how slow I am on the uptake, which we can just take as a given. But when it comes to sort of matters that are burning up national attention, but also I think it shows how capriciously we throw around that sort of crime slash trial of the century tagline. Because you could legitimately say, when we didn't have as many media distractions or inputs coming in, you know, I don't know, let's be ridiculous for a moment and say, like, the Lindbergh trial, you know. You go back then, if you read a daily newspaper, you knew something about the Lindbergh trial. If you ever turned on the radio, you knew something about the Lindbergh trial. The internet was around, flash forward 70 years to when the O.J. Simpson trial was happening, but you'd be hard-pressed to find a person who didn't have a passing familiarity with it. I had never heard Jodi Arias's name until we put this together. And
no kidding.
No.
Like, never heard her name. I mean, I was sort of like, oh, yeah, with the boyfriend and the photos and the, but, you know, I feel like so many other cases sort of rushed in and, you know, took over from her, particularly since she, that case and trial, like, it really dragged on for a while.
Yeah.
But everything tailed off to, you know, to the final after several sentencing mistrials and whatnot. Everything sort of trailed off, and there was like a year pause, and then you have Serial and Making a Murderer and The Jinx. And it's like, she was like the end of the whatever second Bronze Age yeah. of true crime before you could really do something prestige-y with her. She had been completely like unpacked and strewn all over the room by every possible news magazine. So
yeah, and that to me is the most, and that was sort of contained in your introduction, you know, why the word mystery and why you know, what actually is mysterious about this case, what is unknown about it, and two, like why did this one attract a disproportionate amount of attention, which is, you know, sort of a stock question you always ask when a crime becomes this covered and this poured over. But I'm really curious about this one because I think we can name all of the usual suspects, stupid pun, I'm sorry. And all of those are probably true. And yet it's still like the why still kind of squirts away from me. And I that's one of the things I wanted us to get into.
Oh, well, yeah, I think we'll definitely get into it, but I'm finding myself like, you know, restraining myself from like sprinting down the hall from Blotter Presents HQ to my bedroom. This is a glamorous operation, ladies and germs, to grab one of the two copies of Bill James's popular crime that we have in the house, because I'm that guy, and find, because he has somewhere in that book a checklist that he's like, here are the things that I think go into making a crime a popular crime on the order of like Lindbergh. That lady who she and her preacher boyfriend were shot under a tree. Mary Rogers that Poe based the story on. Mm-hmm. OJ, etc., that he has all these axes, and then you get assign a number value. So like, is it a celebrity? Obviously with OJ, that was like on a scale of 1 to 10, that was a 10. Is there marital infidelity? Like he has a whole checklist, and I'd really be interested not only to see how well this fulfills his checklist, but also to see if the checklist, and I don't remember either way if he does this, looks at the baked in, maybe misogyny is too strong, but let's let it stand.
Yeah.
That goes into so many of these stories, and like that if a woman is stepping out of the Madonna role in any way in the story, then people are obsessed with it. And I would also put Casey Anthony in that file, where the mystery element is much larger in that case. Like, I don't know what the hell happened, but the rush to judgment is what makes it popular. And I think you see that in this case, particularly since Travis Alexander, according to his friends and the, you know, post, like the posthumous mythos built up around him, was trying very hard to be a good, observant, chaste Mormon, and Jodi Arias did not allow this to happen. This version of the narrative is really annoying to me.
Oh God, so like, annoying.
Like, he wanted to fuck. He was in his early 20s. There's nothing wrong with that. Or I guess he was 30 when he was killed. But like, you know, we're not all perfect before our God. That's, you know, that's why we're not gods. But this, like many other sort of tabloidy treatments of the of this murder, is pretty interested in painting Travis Alexander as the charismatic, friendly, well-meaning fly that stumbled into her web. In clip two, we're going to hear an example of like, and I don't mean any disrespect to Travis. I didn't know him. He didn't deserve what happened. But they're trying to give him dimension past being the guy who was killed because he wouldn't set a good boundary with Jodi Arias. And the means that they use to this end is not what they should have used, in my opinion.
To say the least.
Here's clip two.
He wasn't just a really good salesman and recruiter, but he was also a motivational speaker. And his speeches were famous.
We don't know what day is our final day here on this earth. But what is for certain is that tomorrow is one day closer.
He would inspire them to reach for the stars and to achieve things. And that's exactly what he did.
Okay, here's the thing. I understand why this clip was pulled, because he's talking about, like, you don't know when you're going to die. Like, But this is not what I would put on my sizzle reel of motivational speaking if I were anyone.
No.
So that was unfortunate that it's like they really were trying to give you a sense of, you know, better than usual sense of the victim as more than a victim, as a person, and the sense of the shape of the hole that he left. And this just made me a little sad, because they pulled it based on the content of what he was saying and not like trying to convince us that he actually was good.
Yeah. It's like it's never enough to say, Travis Alexander at age 30 did not deserve to be stabbed multiple times and then shot in the head and left to bleed to death in his own shower, because no human being deserves that. It's almost like we have to, in order to sell the narrative of the injustice of it all, as if that isn't enough. Right. We have to cook up this idea that Travis was an angel getting his wings. Maybe he didn't have them quite yet, but he was on his way. And this temptress, this harpy stumbled into his life, and he wasn't unwilling to be tempted by her. But in the end, that was his undoing. And it's such a pat misogynistic narrative that it, I, as someone who's done a little public speaking, professionally, I have seen enough of those kind of sad wood paneled conference rooms in a Hyatt hotel by a freeway exit.
Oh, sure. It's like the, Forsyth, and then right. There's no windows and this pink carpeting. You're like, oh my
right.
God.
Right. That's in suburban Indianapolis somewhere. Someone is shooting it from a bad angle on a first generation iPhone or something. By the way, the person tasked with finding the public speaker for things like that, you know, this role that we say Travis Alexander filled so admirably, that is a lousy job. I've been that person before. It is a lousy job to rustle up a monthly or even quarterly speaker for professional or networking events, because you get no praise if it goes well, and you get all the blame if it goes badly.
And there's never enough money.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you can find someone passable, like Travis Alexander, who seems to be charming and friendly and a sort of blandly good looking guy, you just breathe a sigh of relief and you say, thank God.
And like, I don't doubt that he was good at this. I just think it's a pity that of all the footage they must have had of him doing this, they picked the one where he's sort of, you know, on the nosily talking about, you don't know when you're going to die. Like, okay, we're watching Investigation Discovery. Got it.
And by the way, that was 29 minutes into the first episode or something like that.
I will give them credit. They did better than, like, usually you're watching Dateline and like some sort of third best friend is walking brutally along a bridge, and then in an interview is like, she just loved to laugh, and you're like, I absolutely understand that you want to underline the injustice of your loved one's death, but say something. Say an actual something about her, even if it's bad.
It is the streak of American Puritanism that I like the least, or sort of finger on that very big hand, which is like, we can't just say someone didn't deserve to die violently. We have to make it out like they're the sort of person who deserved to live, when in actuality, don't we all?
Yeah, like pretty much all of us. Yeah. I'm definitely thinking about this more in the last 3 to 6 months because of hashtag Me Too and this idea that if a woman is going to give outcry based on sexual harassment or assault that she suffered, that she better never have even jaywalked the rest of her life. Yeah. Like, you know what? You can be a dick and still be a victim. You can be a dictum.
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately it plays into this narrative that was so tantalizing to the hordes of people who followed this trial. But you know, Travis Alexander was a flawed fellow, as we all are, and he had a rough childhood and was trying to, and saw Mormonism as his path to a more fruitful and happy adulthood. Good for him. You know, it can be Mormonism, it can be a job, it can be friends, it can be moving, it can be anything. If you've found a way to improve your station in life, I applaud that.
And he had, I think the beginning of his life was quite difficult. Yeah. So,
but the idea that Jodi Arias was some sort of, what am I trying to say here? Yes. I think we've talked about the great Jill Leovi book Ghetto Side, which is about, you know, a murder investigation in Los Angeles. And there's and told from the point of view of the LAPD investigators. And one of the side points she makes is that murder is almost always a crime of intimacy. Murders between two complete strangers are exceedingly rare. And most murders are over, you know, sort of the big things we worry about and have conflict in life: money, sex, custody, you know, directions that relationships, directions that people are going either the same or different. And so there are probably, if you look at all the murders in this country, probably an appallingly high number of them are what we would sort of facilely call lovers' quarrels. The question then is why this one? You know, if this is in fact a quarrel between two people who were having sex and were in and out of a romantic relationship, maybe it's the level of brutality, but I think it's a lot of the point you raised, which is that we want to paint, which is despite the fact that she's really, really weird and and a terrible advocate for herself, we want to paint Jodi Arias as some sort of slut that drew in this poor guy, and then when he rejected her or felt like the relationship had run its course, you know, died brutally at her hand.
Well, and I think the actual truth, to say that she was this, that there was this like nefariousness to it, I think is more comforting to people, and, you know, perhaps particularly to straight men who are like, well, I would be able to avoid that. But the truth is so much more pathetic. Let's listen to clip 3 and get into that a little more.
From the time she was a young teenager, Jodi Arias always had a boyfriend. She went from one to another. And this became maybe a weakness of hers, her attraction to men.
And despite already having a serious boyfriend, Jodi falls hard for the handsome Mormon salesman.
Jodi and Travis clearly have a connection, but they live in separate cities, separate states. So they go their separate ways, and Jodi goes back to her boyfriend. And within a couple of days, she breaks up with her boyfriend of 4 years because of Travis Alexander. In fact, she tells him, I'm saving myself for my future husband.
Okay, you will see in our visual aids, which are available on social media, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Blotter Presents. The guy they have playing the reenactor of her much older, probably twice or three times her age,
yeah,
boyfriend, is dressed so frumpily. He looks like he's in one of those ads for like the Owl flashlight.
Yeah.
It's classic. And then he's sort of like, all right, like she's packing up and leaving. He's like, but okay. It's funny. You could see that in, you could see that if you follow us on Twitter.
Yeah. It's like shot in slow motion and from some absurd angle, like on the top kitchen shelf or something like that. Like,
and I will, yeah, I, why? It's like Paranormal Activity cam. It's hilarious. And then on top of that, the reenactor playing Jody, like, it's really not all that close. And bless her heart, she has this, like, beautiful rest of Diet Coke on it booty that is, bears no similarity to the actual, to the original article. But anyway, I mean, it's a great butt, but it's not the same butt. Anyway.
No, it's
I am not a doctor. I am not a licensed clinical psychologist, any of that. But I feel like this, you know, always having a boyfriend, overreacting to what seems like destiny. She converts to Mormonism after she and Travis break up. Then she moves to Mesa. Like, this seems like, if it's not some kind of borderline personality disorder, it's some kind of like cognitive attachment misfiring of some kind. Again, just an English major, don't really know what I'm talking about. And we welcome your comments / pushback on social media and on our forums at previously.tv. But it always just seemed clear to me, like, she's, even if she's just trying to flail around and figure out who she is, and she's making attachments that are just really not ideal for her, and not understanding, you know, not having any perspective on it, like, who among us at that age,
yeah,
was not doing that? Very few of us. Like, certainly I was, you know, flailing around in my romantic life until I was like 38. I
mean, and do you find that the series really stacks the deck? I mean, we hear from Travis's colleagues and family, and yes, we get passing commentary from, I believe, Jody's parents and maybe one of her siblings, but it
which is like, it's contemporaneous footage. Like, I think we really only get like one friend in the present day of Travis's, and then some law enforcement and a couple of the attorneys, but then friends and family, it's all taken from like interrogation footage at the time.
Yeah,
anyway, go ahead.
But based on what you're saying, wouldn't it make sense to have, you know, Jody Aris's buddy or girlfriend say, I really thought Jody had, you know, some unhealthy attachments to people, and I begged her to get some help or some therapy or something like that. Like there's something really shrill and judgy about hearing that from, you know, the designated legal analyst talking head who, based on their tone and simply the position they have in this whole thing, has already clearly made up their mind on the guilt or innocence of Jody.
Well, and it's also possible that you just didn't have any girlfriends. Yeah. Like, this type of person is the type, and I remember this type from college and being in my 20s, that it was like, if she was around, she was completely focused on either catching the next one or getting the last one back. And it was wearing, because you're like, don't you read any books? But that said, I don't know what was tried on the production end. Maybe she didn't have any friends like that. But I do know that even though Travis is continuing to bone her and sending her those signals, which, like, you do get to a certain point where you have to, like, just at least put a post-it on your mirror that's like, don't confuse sex with love. But he kept doing it, and yet somehow this failure to set the boundary with her is put on him, or is put on her, in clip 4.
Despite his initial objections, Travis finds it difficult to cut the cord.
Travis was telling people that he wanted her out of his life, but he was also having sex with her.
Jody knew how to lure Travis in with sex. He wanted a clean moral life, but that's very hard to do when you've got a girlfriend that's sneaking over in your house in the middle of the night, sneaking up into your bedroom and getting naked and crawling in your bed.
Look, I'm not victim blaming here. I'm really not. But if you really want a clean moral life, change the fucking locks, bro. Like, some of this is on you. Not getting killed, right, of course. But the fact that she's like, well, but we're still doing everything we did when we were going out. You just won't claim me.
And let's not forget how this crime was discovered in the first place. This crime was discovered by a young woman who was supposed to go to Cancun, quote, as friends with Travis Alexander.
She wanted to go as friends. He was trying to get a leg over. And again, fine. Like, everyone has needs.
Yeah.
Do you?
Or her.
Or her, if she goes for that. I think she had a boyfriend or whatever. But it's like, let's not act like Travis was strapping, like he had 1.5 wings on. And Jody came and, you know, vagina dentata'd him to death. It's not what happened.
No.
And second of all, let's not act like, even though that's not what happened, that he deserved what happened to him. It's not either or.
No. But I feel like that the high-handedness contained in an either or analysis is part of what makes this so captivating to people. Like, I can feel self-righteous and certain in my judgment, but simply by picking up one of these sort of tired moralistic cliches off the table. God, this case makes more of those false certainties available than many I've seen in a long time.
Well, and it's like, you know, I find Jody off-putting too, and I think another plank in the she did it and we should literally burn her at the stake platform was her willingness to try at least to use the media to leverage it to her own advantage instead of just sort of sitting there, hands in her lap, eyes down in the courtroom. Jody is not as good at that as she thought she was, and someone like our old non-friend Nancy Grace is going to eat her for breakfast when she even tries it just for existing. Clip 5.
Every time that she is asked a question, she's got this, oh, there she is putting on makeup. I'm so glad I saw that. Got to get your makeup straight before you're asked questions about your lover's murder.
You know what? Bitch. Don't make me take Jody Arias aside.
I mean, people,
she did it and she sucks. But like, there comes a point, like, just let her hang herself then. Like, why do you have to be so Nancy Grace about everything, Nancy Grace?
And you don't have to manufacture the rope from the nylon factory, like Nancy Grace. Like, Jody Arias is doing a perfectly good job of that herself.
Yeah.
Nancy Grace's habit of calling into evidence things that every one of us does every day outside the bounds of a courtroom. I think it's sort of referring to and doing it in the name of justice. I just think it's so wrongheaded and sad. Like,
well, and she's built an empire on this, but it's like the double standard, and she's as guilty as anyone.
Yeah.
Of like this double standard of like how a woman accused of a crime is supposed to behave, which is basically we're supposed to just kill ourselves.
Right.
Like, that's the bottom line, that it's like, just go away.
Right. Right. The very fact that I've breathed word of your guilt means we should just presume it. And like, you know, like our friend and hero Bill James points out in the Bill James book you gave me, The Man on the Train, anything can be shaded as evidence of guilt. If you're pre-wiring yourself to look for it that way.
Oh, sure.
Someone isn't upfront about what they about where they were that night. They're hiding something. Someone was too upfront about where they were that night. They're confessing all over the place in a way to in an attempt to obscure what actually happened. I don't know. I do wonder if the roles were reversed. If it were Jodi Arias who had bled to death in a shower and Travis Alexander who was on trial for it, would Nancy Grace be looking down her witch nose at Travis Alexander?
Well, if he had mounted, as it were, the defense that he was a victim of domestic violence, I have a feeling that she would be like literally trying to kill him with paper cuts. But first, before we get into that any further, let's talk about how the trial, and I think both sides of the trial, perhaps unconsciously, but I doubt it, tried to use sex like against each other, often quite clumsily. I was a little surprised. Like, I know it's a Crime Network, and I think this aired at like, whatever, 9 o'clock at night. I was a little surprised at some of the trial footage that they aired on this thing. This is not super safe for work. So if you're listening to this with your kids in the car, first of all, thank you. Second of all, what are you doing? And third of all, you might want to fast forward like 10 minutes. Here's clip 6.
And during the time that he was kissing, and again, not to get too much into this, he achieved an erection, right?
Yes.
You did not massage his erection, right?
Correct.
He did not massage his own erection, correct?
Correct.
It was a biological response to your lips, wasn't it?
Correct.
And that, at that time, because of your inexperience, you thought that he should have controlled his penis from becoming tumescent or getting big just because he was kissing you. You thought that's what the problem was, right?
Yes. Yes.
I still am not quite clear on why. This is not Jodi. This is the prosecutor questioning some other girlfriend of Travis's. I think basically to imply that like whatever biological responses Travis was having were Jodi's fault.
I was really unclear on that line of questioning. Quick side note: I would love to have gone back to the preparations in the prosecutor's office that morning where he underlined the word tumescent and undoubtedly some paralegal who was working with him said, you know, put in a red pen next to it. What does this mean? Getting why are we bringing this
big
up?
Yeah. Like the witness is just like, I know what tumescent is. Could this please be over?
Yeah.
Not as amazing as the cutaways to, Travis's friends and family and Jodi's as well in the gallery when their entire, like one of their whole phone sex exchanges is playing.
Yeah.
I didn't cut the whole thing because even I'm too prudish to get to the end, as it were. This is not a family show, but still. But you will see that in the visual aids on our social media as well. Like just that they are like either about to barf or start screaming. And why was this played in court? Well, one of the talking heads in the show has a theory in clip 7.
I don't know why Jodi Arias recorded this, unless it was to use against him later.
So touching yourself.
I am already.
I just started.
I wish those were my hands giving you a
oh God. That is the most uncomfortable I've been.
Oh yeah.
Like and I made the cat leave the room. I was like, you're only a year old. Get out.
Could we again, like the calling into evidence something that isn't, or creating a mystery where there is none to be found. Maybe the answer is simply Jodi Arias was in a long distance relationship with Travis Alexander and she recorded it so she could refer to it later when.
Yeah. Or she was, her hands were full and her elbow hit record. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Or she wanted to take it to her bunk later.
Yeah. I mean, you know, All manner of things get recorded that we later wonder why anybody in their right mind would do so. I mean, you know, not to make this about the most obvious trial of the century in big air quotes, but like, why did Mark Furman consent to be recorded in a 2-hour interview where he said all sorts of racist bullshit about what he did as an LAPD officer? You know, did he think that was going to go in a shoebox on someone's shelves, never to emerge again? Maybe he didn't care. I don't know. But
yeah, and I don't know. Like, not everything. I mean, I personally do not think the domestic violence defense is credible. There was nothing about it in her journals. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. She, of course, had an answer for that. I don't even remember what it was. And it was like, maybe. But I forget who I was talking to about this. It was like, well, it's not like Nicole Simpson journaled about it. I'm like, yeah, she did. Watch Made in America. She journaled about it like every day.
Yeah. And the idea that Travis Alexander flew into a rage over a damaged camera and Jodi Arias feared for her life because of it. I mean, recall the night of his murder begins with her driving, you know, several hundred miles to, you know,
to do a pop in. Yeah.
Yeah. For an interstate booty call, basically. And so I think that really cuts into the credibility of the domestic violence argument, because at the very least, even if Travis Alexander was angry, it would be out of character for him to engage in violence because of that. And there seemed to be no serial pattern of it at any time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most obvious explanation is that, you know, she showed up. She was good enough to fuck, but not to take home. She had planned on sort of telling herself some more that wasn't the case. And then he was like, well, I got a shower and packed to go to Cancun with someone else, so you can let yourself out, right? Mm-hmm. And she lost it. And like, I've been on the end of that kind of conversation where it's like, you really can't tell yourself anymore that this situation is going to right itself. Like, you know, money's on the table, you can go kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to kill anybody.
Yeah.
But you can see how it happened. It doesn't excuse it. But I have compassion for that part of it. Like, up until she picks up a kitchen knife and goes ham on him, excuse me for the sort of whatever glib.
Yeah, the non-kosher reference.
Yeah. Oh.
Sorry.
You get out.
Yeah.
That was good. Nice, yeah. Nice bit of business. But then it's like, all right, the fact is she really didn't do anything after that that made her sympathetic. I'm not sure if she had just been like, look, he'd been using me for sex and I lost it. I'm not sure that would have helped her, but like, doing a headstand in the interrogation room, singing Oh Holy Night, having these press conferences, like changing her hair and dressing like a 14-year-old. Like, you can see this again in our photos and or screen grabs and the visual aids. Like, she definitely was like with the bangs combed down and the little glasses, like trying to look innocent and put upon.
Yeah.
And then there's clip 8. Oh God, so cringy. This is Jodi at one of her sentencing hearings. Yeah, she probably just should have stayed seated. Clip 8.
My arrest. I wanted so much to avoid trial. I got on TV and I lied. I lied about what I did. And I lied about the nature of my relationship with Travis. It's never been my intention to malign his name or character. In fact, it was a goal of mine to preserve his reputation. I didn't want to drag out Travis's skeletons or mine and explain my experiences with him. Additionally, I've designed a t-shirt.
Oh.
This is the t-shirt.
Then Then, at the end, she whips out a t-shirt with the word survivor on it and says, I want to help victims of domestic violence.
100% of the proceeds go to support nonprofit organizations, which also assist other victims of domestic violence.
It just was not a good move.
I have dug a hole in the floorboards with my fingernails trying to escape from this.
Yes, I am transmitting through my sweater right now. Yeah. Like, I can't. That she steps back and like unfurls the t-shirt. First of all, it's so like, it's such a basic t-shirt. Second of all, she can't even get through that. It's like, pick one organization. Also, yeah, of course, 100% of the proceeds go to that. Son of Sam laws, fool. You convicted. Oh, my God. She is so slappable. Like, she really is. But
yeah,
it's like she did it.
Mm-hmm.
She's slappable enough on her own. And I just, it's not like, whatever. I'm not asking for her to be freed. She got life in prison, no parole eventually. I think that's correct. I think she just needs to sit and read some books and make some license plates and not date.
Yeah.
And that, like, that's all fine. It doesn't bring Travis back, of course, but it's like, there is something about the coverage of this kind of case that is very troubling in terms of what a woman, quote unquote, has to be in order to be considered worthy even of like an attempt at understanding. Forget yeah. compassion. So
yeah, the idea, like I was about to be overly glib and say, well, being slappable isn't a crime, and the truth is it is.
Yeah.
Once someone's found guilty or innocent, what they are sentenced to is, you know, let me start over with that. Part of the evidence that works into guilt or innocence, and no jury would say this, even though we all know it's true, is often how slappable or not, or admirable or not, we think the person on trial is, whether or not that has anything to do with the crime they're actually on trial for.
Yeah.
Jodi Arias does herself no favors. And I'm not saying the result would have been all that different if she was a more sympathetic person who didn't do these outrageously cringeworthy and stupid gestures like she did. There seems to be a very firm understanding in this culture of how a defendant of a crime is supposed to act.
And we have particularly a woman defendant, like Amanda Knox spent how long in Italian jail? Cause she was like doing yoga stretches in the police station. Like,
yeah, particularly a woman. It is almost entirely unstated, and yet we act like it's something everybody is supposed to know.
Yeah.
We act like it's the Ten Commandments, and really we have never, collectively, we have never spoken of or laid out how a person convicted of a crime is supposed to act. Because the truth is, there is no supposed to. You know, that's not what ultimately we have a system where we convict on we should have a system where evidence leads to reasonable or not reasonable doubt.
Well, and that the burden of proof is on the prosecution, something
yeah.
people also tend to forget. And, you know, finally, not everyone is in a position to afford the kind of defense representation that is going to be able to massage how slappable you are.
So, exactly. Yeah, there's an entire industry set up to de-slappable a defendant.
Yeah, there really is. And a lot of lower income defendants of color, certainly, like people sitting in Rikers for months and years because they can't make bail.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you finally appear in front of a judge for an arraignment, you'd better not look slappable.
Yeah,
or
convictable before any either attorney has started speaking.
Yeah.
I have a quick side point. Did you find the public defender a particularly interesting character? And maybe it was just me, but did you notice sort of he looked like your basic, you know, beaten down by the system and the demands of the job public defender during the footage they had of the trial? And then when they cut to him in the present day as one of the talking heads, he's got a full head of hair. He's got no beard. He's easily lost 30 or 40 pounds. He's got a fashionable set of eyeglasses, and he's no longer wearing that weird two-tone tie shirt combination. And I'm like, man, I'd like to hear a little bit about Kurt Nurmi's transformation between the trial and now.
Well, and you have to imagine that the trial meant mm-hmm. that he could leapfrog into private practice, which is what I imagine happened. But listeners, if you know offhand that progression, or you want to Google it for us, hit us on the forums, previously.tv/forums, or we're happy to hear from you on Twitter at Blotter Presents. Let's wrap up this section, but I thought on balance, this was pretty good. Like these, they've done a bunch of these American murder mysteries now, and sometimes they can go on a little too long. I feel like maybe they could have crammed this one into two mm-hmm. instead of three, but this was very watchable. The only drawback, as we've been saying all along, is that there's a thumb on the scale for the Jodie Black Widow narrative. And I think the reality, which they did have time to nuance, is quite a bit more pathetic and actually maybe relatable than what we ever saw with this case. Did you enjoy watching this? Was it a slog?
No, I did. And I was definitely captivated by it. And I think in its own lurid, you know, kind of way that I see as becoming sort of the House style of investigative discovery based on the, you know, three or four series I've watched on that network. I appreciate the what I sort of sloppily call the All the President's Men principle, which is when you are making a movie or a television series about a well-known media event that has been covered to death, there is a certain virtue in simply being level-headed and straightforward about it, and just kind of laying out the steps one at a time and leaving it at that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think this is actually a pretty servicey, and I think I've said this about previous installments, like if you know the case well, this probably isn't for you.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is this is stuff that you already know. If you saw the Lifetime movie, if you have read any of the books, this probably isn't for you. For people like us who either had never heard her name before, like Kevin, or for me who were like, I know what she did and to whom, but I'd forgotten the particulars. Mm-hmm. This is a solid overview.
Yeah.
Workmanlike, but sometimes that's enough. And especially on this network, it's like, just don't, you know, it's not Wives with Knives. We'll take it.
Yeah. Workmanlike is actually a refreshing change of pace, both for this case and the kind of programs that ID typically.
All right, moving on to our cold case segment. And there is something of a tie to the OJ case. We'll get to it. We are discussing episode 4 of The 80s, The Deadliest Decade. This series has been recommended to me before. I think a listener wanted me to watch the, what was his name? Charles Stewart, who killed his pregnant wife and like pushed her off a bridge and then claimed it was African Americans who carjacked them.
Oh,
it was in Boston, I think. Mm-hmm. Anyway, someone recommended that I watch the series. I hadn't gotten to it because hashtag peak TV. Mm-hmm. But Kevin suggested that we take a look. I picked out episode 4, which is the episode concerning the murder of Rebecca Schaefer. Here's the case file. On July 18th, 1989, and we will be getting back to that date. Sorry, not sorry, everybody who listened last week. Rebecca Schaefer was murdered by a stalker toting a copy of the Nutty Assassin's Bible, Catcher in the Rye. And that's not the only familiar totem in this case, as the Deadliest Decade unpacks not just how this could happen, but whether it would happen the same way today. Before we get into my grand unifying theory of the middle of July, Kevin, you selected this for our cold case segment. Any particular reason, or was it just something that was on your mind as co-branding with your non-murdery book?
I should say that there's a vague connection to my non-murdery book. I wrote a book called Rat Pack America, A Love Letter to 80s Teen Movies. And there are one or two 80s teen movies that feature sort of high-profile murders. I would say most notably The River's Edge, which was about the true life case of a teenage boy in suburban San Jose, California, who killed his girlfriend and then left her dead body by the side of the American River, and then invited his friends over to hang out and party around her dead corpse. Totally true story, 1981, and then it was made into a 1986 movie that was the first winner of the Independent Spirit Award for Best Picture.
And is excellent. And one of the only Dennis Hopper roles where he's doing that Dennis Hopper thing he does, where it actually works for me.
Yeah, and is the beginning of the comeback of Dennis Hopper. That movie leads to, you know, Dennis Hopper in True Romance, you know, 6 years later. I found the 80s Deadliest Decade series doing a search on some other related 80s newsmentary that someone recommended I see because I wrote this book. And it popped up on Xfinity Cable and it said 80s Deadliest Decade. And that's all you need to get me interested. So I went ahead and recorded it. And what I've been fascinated with watching the series is the attempts, both, you know, not needed and really clumsy, to connect a time in history to the crimes that took place there. As if these crimes were a result of what was in the air at that time, or were somehow reflective of what was in the air at that time.
Look, they have a story and they're sticking to it, even starting with the theme music. Let me just play a little clip.
Yeah.
Say no. Somewhere Nancy's restless ghost is like, why is this?
Yes.
Why is it that? I said 100,000 fucking things. Why that one? Yeah. Why am I always next to a Rubik's Cube?
I was in movies with Frank Sinatra, for God's sakes.
I know.
A serious deep cut there too from the 80s from the English hardcore punk band Killing Joke. I don't know how some very smart music supervisor found that one. But I wonder if there's a better case to be made on this Rebecca Schaefer episode, that the murder of Rebecca Schaefer happens in part because of the sort of lackadaisical barricades or non-barricades set up between famous people and their fans. It perhaps didn't help that Rebecca Schaefer was more open with her fans than most celebrities were at that time. And this is, of course, before Instagram and Twitter, and it practically compels such things to be so. Series makes the case that the horrible murder of Rebecca Schaefer leads to increased protection, not only for famous people, but for unfamous people too. And I think that is important. We would not have, you know, as flawed and as sloppily, you know, enforced as it is, we do have stalking laws on the book thanks to this, because of this terrible thing that happened to Rebecca Schaefer.
Yeah. And I think to an extent to the not really parallel, but somewhat similar thing that happened to Dominique Dunn.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is not mentioned at all in this.
No, which I found very odd.
I did too.
But yeah, in any case, certainly the show is at pains to establish that she wasn't one of those coke sluts that might have deserved to get her ass killed in clip 10.
In an era of hard-charging, party-going young celebrities like Rob Lowe and Demi Moore, Rebecca is the anti-brat packer.
Rebecca was never into the party or that lifestyle.
There was no need to even say, don't bring drugs around her. She was well-rounded. She sat at home and did crafts. She wrote poetry.
Okay, like you can do crafts, write poetry, and still be a functional college alcoholic. Yeah, says a friend of mine. Once again, and they are at pains to use like the cutest, most innocent possible pictures of her. Rebecca Schaefer was in My Sister Sam. I actually thought she was the My Two Dads girl, so no. I was confused. I didn't watch a lot of TV in the 80s, clearly.
Yeah, that actress's name was Stacy Keenan,
I think. Keenan, yes, yeah. As I found out later while watching this. But yes, once again, there's that setup that's like, so, you know, in addition to being young and pretty, like there is this point system that's like, how really undeserving of being murdered are you? Like, let's just assume everyone is.
Yeah.
And then, like, who might be a little deserving of getting killed?
And
pedophiles.
Pedophiles, spousal abusers, like, you know, people who've murdered themselves, like that. And, you know, I hate to be the person who
Patriots
asked
fans. Sorry, but, not sorry. Just kidding. I actually am sorry. Congratulations, I guess.
I hate to be the person who keeps having to make this distinction because it was 30 years ago and fundamentally, who cares? But the brat pack as such, you know, we're all in the same room for precisely one movie and very like the only ones of them that were actually friends were Judd Nelson and Emilio Estevez. I interviewed Andrew McCarthy for a salon piece I did last year. And it came up very briefly, and he said, I keep having to tell people that after we shot St. Elmo's Fire, I never saw those guys again. It's not like we all hung out together. And the age difference between the different actors we associate in that group, here's a creepy statistic for you. Judd Nelson was 24 and Molly Ringwald was 16 when they were in the Breakfast Club together. They were, you know, collectively, it would be very hard to even call them peers because some of them were in their mid-20s and some of them were barely out of high school or still in high school. And Rebecca Schaefer, who happened to be a young actor on television at this time, and let's not forget that there was a pretty high wall between TV and movies.
Oh, there definitely was. And that persisted for almost 20 years after that is A. B, when did St. Elmo's come out? 87?
86, summer 86. Of 86.
And the Brat Pack was already, like, even as a concept, was fraying before the movie even hit the ground.
Yeah.
Which it did with a splat and with good reason.
Yeah.
But it's like the late 80s and the middle 80s are completely different animals. I was there.
Oh, yeah.
You could tell even while it was happening. Like, just something happened when Def Leppard came back after the guy lost his arm, and it was like, this is different. Something changed.
Totally.
I'm just saying it was right around there. And it's like, but it's very easy, especially if you're just like, I don't know, people are watching hotel TV who are 28 and weren't there, that it's like in an era of hard charging partiers. And also, can we stop using the word hard charging?
Yeah,
for partying. That's
yeah.
Not what
unless
it's
we're
for.
Talking about racehorses, like let's just not.
But yeah, I mean, the show is pretty watchable because it's like all these vintage, like graphics and stuff, and it's a case that I didn't really know well. This was a perfect storm of problems. Rebecca Schaefer was very personable and wrote like notes personally back to her fans.
Mm-hmm.
her buzzer was broken and she was expecting a script to be dropped off. So she came to the door. Mm-hmm. She probably would have anyway. And this guy was very troubled and once again was using poor J.D. Salinger as the angle, and actually specifically the murder of John Lennon, because he wanted to be remembered the same way Chapman was. So he shows up on the set. Like, now that guy would be in some kind of, like, you know, personal security holding pen six stories under a parking garage at Universal Studios. Not back then, clip 11.
Nowadays, that guard would have been notifying the police, everybody, it is her mother, her father.
But this is 1987. Unless fans make overt threats, they're shrugged off.
You hear, oh, a fan got on the set and wanted an autograph or wanted to meet somebody. I certainly didn't, before that time, go to any mischievous, scary place.
Jack said, well, where are you staying? I'll drive you back to the hotel. He actually drove him.
The voice we heard at the top of that clip was Marcia Clark. And
yes.
I forget that she was on this case and a couple others involving this kind of crime that really make it, to me, that much more sort of frustrating, I guess, that she wasn't able to, she wasn't able to sort of make the O.J. Simpson jury feel how those murders proceeded from an extremely abusive relationship between OJ and Nicole, by which I mean he was abusing her. The relationship was not abusive, he was. So that's sort of like, I don't know. She's also one of my favorite talking heads in Made in America. Like, she does not mince words. And I always felt like she, like, talk about suffering from what America thinks you're supposed to be in a justice environment. So
absolutely. I didn't know that. So if the Rebecca Schaefer case was 87 and the O.J. Simpson trial was 94, I didn't realize Marcia Clark had spent that long at the L.A. District Attorney's office. Like most attorneys don't, because it's, you know, because if you're any good, there's greener, more bountiful pastures in private practice. And I remember that the coverage during the case, during the O.J. Simpson trial, was at pains to paint Marcia Clark as kind of young and inexperienced and, you know, the wrong choice from the district attorney's office to be prosecuting this case. And none of that was true. Like Marcia Clark had been there, done that before.
Yeah, I mean, when you look in, you'll see it on our Twitter feed, like, she does look real young. She's wearing all the makeup. Mm-hmm. But she kind of looks like she's in a, like, Model UN. Like, yeah. She's young.
Yeah, but she had prosecuted these kind of cases before when the O.J. Simpson trial came along. And I remember how sort of unfair the coverage and analysis was of her performance as an attorney. And that was one of the things that I remember being dug up frequently as to how sort of inexperienced she was, which was,
yeah, but she actually was, yeah, like, quite experienced in domestic violence murders, I believe.
Yeah.
In our next clip, she's talking a little bit more about the investigation. I get the feeling that the show had a much longer, or like, much more footage that we didn't get to hear that was a little bit more nuanced than what we actually hear about their trying to prove. I mean, it wasn't really that complicated. Like, the guy was wandering around in traffic in Arizona, like, mm-hmm, claiming that he did it. But there were sort of two issues. Like, was he sane enough to stand trial? Did he know what he was doing at the time? And was it premeditated? He had sent Schaefer a lot of very sweet fan letters, but then he had some really murdery ones in the attic. We'll hear a little bit about that in clip 12.
It was the top of every newscast. It was front page. It was very shocking.
The murder absolutely put Rebecca in a huge spotlight. It wasn't the spotlight she was supposed to have.
I was sitting literally in the office when we spoke at the district attorney's office.
Marcia Clark, who later gained fame for prosecuting O.J. Simpson in 1995, takes on the Schaefer murder case shortly after the actress is shot dead.
We were working shoulder to shoulder with the detectives right from the very start.
Yeah, I would have liked to hear more about that part of it and a little less like, here's the obligatory picture of all the St. Elmosians at brunch.
Yeah.
Like, I get it, but also like, here's your story. Like, don't bury the lead. This is 20 minutes into the show by now.
Yeah, I've seen probably, I think there's been 12 of these episodes, and I've seen episodes of this series over two seasons.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And I think I've seen four or five of them. And I find that, like, as is the case with the sort of distant ancestors of this series, like Unsolved Mysteries, pacing is everything. Like how you dole out the information, how you sort of, you know, teeter precariously between presenting evidence and sort of slobbering over it. I think the thing that makes this show watchable instead of just cringy trashy is its pacing. That that it manages to exact drama out of an inherently dramatic situation without feeling too, you know, Mistoffelian about it.
Yeah, it would have helped me, I think. I didn't think the pacing was great, especially in cases like this where, like, it's a true crime show.
Yeah,
we know that she's dead, so get to step in. Like,
yeah.
Like, well, here's why, and, like, here's yet another reenactment of her, like, signing one of her own photos. Like, all right, there's no other way to put this, so I'm just gonna say it, understanding as always that I don't mean any disrespect, you got a killer up top.
Yeah,
you could think what you want about how American Crime Story is handling that vis-a-vis the death of Gianni Versace this season. I thought it was smart because it's like, do we want to get to know this character? Sure. But it's going to be looming over the whole series. So just get that done and then flashback. Anyway,
don't pretend like the suspense or drama is the murder, because it's not.
Yeah, and like, this could have been avoided. Like that actually is true, but it wasn't. So get the actual event out of the way and then maybe start, you know, 3 weeks previous. That's fine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree. I think the pacing is lackluster in this particular episode of the series. Almost generally, I think with one or two exceptions, but almost to the one that I've seen, these are not unsolved murders or cases where the guilt of someone is in question. These are always matters that are, where at the end, it has already been decided, you know, who was guilty, and the guilty have been punished.
Right. So the trick in these cases, I find, and I'm still trying to come up with a good term for this, is like, how long before you start just Googling the case yourself? Like, I was a little impatient with this episode, and I went and Googled the case myself, just to see. You know, just to see. So with shows like this, there is that, like, I don't know what you would call it, search bifurcation point, where it's like, if your pacing isn't spot on / I don't have my hands full of a knitting project while I'm watching it taking notes,
all right,
I'm gonna take a side road and Google it instead. Would you say that happens more often than not with this series, or should I try some other episodes and see?
I think it's worth trying some other episodes, because to me, the two things I'm interested in are, does this have anything to do with the culture of that time, or is it simply a convenient awning to put all of these crimes under?
Right. That was my other question.
Yeah. And two, that's one of the interests, the thing I'm most interested in here. And two, where did this take us in the present? I think the Rebecca Schaefer episode specifically would have been I don't think the trial is all that interesting. I don't think the lead up to how it happened is all that interesting. What resulted from it is interesting, particularly now that we're in a culture where, you know, there's a semi-permeable membrane between celebrities and their fans in a way there hasn't been before. That to me is really interesting. You know, these laws get on the books, but what does it mean in the era of, you know, Instagram and Snapchat?
Right, and that this occurred before not only social media, but before just celebrity culture as we understand it now was much different. So that this still occurred, like it's, you know, it's pre-internet, it's pre-TMZ, it's pre a lot of things. It's also pre, I would say, our really understanding and flagging as lay people certain behaviors as stalking and inappropriate.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And the, you know, I guess maybe one could argue badly, but one could argue that the reason Dominic Dunn isn't mentioned in this episode is because Dominic Dunn was killed by someone she was in a romantic relationship with.
Yeah.
And not a stranger and not a stalker, but I feel like they're two sides of the same coin. You know, the Dorothy Stratton murder, you know, figures in here as well. She was in a romantic relationship with whom she had rejected and was moving on from. And he killed her because of that.
Yeah.
And I think the same is true with Dominic Dunn, which was only 5 years before Rebecca Schaefer.
I think he pled down to something and got like 18 months. And her father was like, and career change.
Right.
And that so, created the Dominic Dunn that we knew from Vanity Fair et al.
Exactly. Exactly. There is something to, I didn't expect anybody making this series to go down the same back alley I did, but I ended up on Rebecca Schaefer's Wikipedia page, you know, 43 minutes into this series. And at the bottom is, you know, where they have all of those like hyperlinks of the different sort of categories that Wikipedia page fits under.
Oh, no.
One of them, yeah, no. One of them, and you can totally tell where this is going, is murdered actors. And so I clicked on murdered actors, and I found myself scrolling through all of these awful cases of actors who have died at someone else's hand. And you realize that we may know some of the more lurid sensationalist ones like Dorothy Stratton and Dominic Dunn, who were both killed by ex-boyfriends. And some of the ones where there really is, you know, a mystery like George Reeves, like we don't know who killed, you know, George Reeves. But a disproportionate number of these are, you know, a scorned stepchild, an angry business associate, a deal legal or illegal gone wrong. And you realize that like being famous, you know, even in the era of when famous people were seen as sort of distant as stars in distant galaxies, being famous involves inviting a lot of people intimately into your life. You may get to pick and choose all of them, but they have access to you at all times.
Or they think they do.
And
that's the danger. Actually, before I forget, I just want to recommend for more on sort of a sliver of this topic, the You Must Remember This podcast by Karina Longworth, which is excellent regardless.
Absolutely.
My favorite season is Manson's Hollywood, but pursuant to this topic, the Dead Blondes.
What a great series.
Excellent. And she specifically addressed Dorothy Stratton. And I thought that was a very good sort of well-built episode, because that case was very strange. And then Bogdanovich's whole thing. I mean, it's a lot. And Longworth is excellent. So I recommend.
Yeah, that's a great series.
Won't you?
That's right.
I love her.
yeah, that's really, I can't wait for the next season to come out.
I know, me too.
Yeah.
These things aren't any work at all, by the way.
No. All for our benefit.
All right. Well, let me just play this last clip. And then speaking of work, we can wrap it up with some thoughts on the 80s. And you can plug your book. Here is clip 13.
We looked up in the attic in the garage and found a pretty good sized cardboard box full of information about her. Newspaper clippings, magazine clippings, and such.
As police sift through the papers, they uncover a pile of disturbing, rage-filled letters that Bardo wrote to Rebecca.
The threatening letters were ones that he kept. These letters stayed in his attic. They talked about her having a hole in her soul and all these horrible things. They were very dark.
Yeah. I mean, you know, being a public figure and especially a young one. And I think for actors, it's very difficult to know where to put the line because
yeah.
You want to be accessible and popular and liked,
mm-hmm.
but especially for women and the socialization of women and everyone around us, it can get dicey because you're just trying to be a nice person and thank them for watching or listening. And the next thing you know, shit's showing up at your house.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, be careful out there, everybody, and read The Gift of Fear.
And part of I think part of this tragedy, in addition to all of the other stuff that screams loud and clear as a tragedy, is there's a particular slant to what happened to Rebecca Schaefer, which is about being early in your career and on your way up, because you're inclined, the inclination, and it's a good one at that point, is of course to be popular and liked, but to see everything as part of the bounty and good fortune, or at least an opportunity for more of the good fortune that is happening to you. And I think we've all been there when good things have happened to us professionally. And so, yeah, Rebecca Schaefer, and this is something that's totally unfair to actresses versus actors, probably had, if she'd talked to anyone more experienced in her field, any conversation she'd had with Pam Dauber, her co-star on My Sister Sam, probably some part of it was like, yeah, you know, you don't want to get a reputation as a bitch. Like, yeah. You don't want to get a reputation as someone who isn't nice to the people who tune in every Wednesday night. Which is something I'm guessing that Robin Williams on Mork and Mindy did not have to watch out for.
Meanwhile, Pam Dauber, she's married to Mark Harmon, right? Or she was?
I think she's still married to Mark Harmon.
Yeah, who played Ted Bundy. So it's all a circle of whatever that is.
Right. I bring this up because I just saw the documentary about Rick Springfield, An Affair of the Heart, and he has a very close relationship with his fans. And putting this next to the Rebecca Schaefer murder, you have to ask, you know, is Rick Springfield able to do that, A, because he's a man, and B, because he was most famous a long time ago. And so the people who are still rabid Rick Springfield fans have kind of self-selected out the weirdos, and there's something a little bit purer and more innocent about their interest now.
Yeah, I think also Australians just have a different attitude towards life. Like, it's hard to explain, but I can see. Like, if he and, for example, John Stamos mm-hmm. both played, who were both on General Hospital at the same time.
Oh, my, I didn't know that.
Were in some, like, I don't know, like, confronted with the same stalker situation at the same time. I just think an Australian is more likely to be like, it's good. Just be cool. Just be cool. It's all right. Just be cool. I'm going to call my friend. He happens to be a cop. We're going to ask you, you know, you're going to get some help and it's going to be fine. And yeah. Stamos would like dive into a sewer grate. Like, actually, I don't know if Stamos would do that. He might be cool also, but like, I just feel like Australians have this much more like, okay, I hear what you're saying and it seems pretty crazy to me, but we're going to work it out attitude about this stuff.
Yeah. And unflappability.
Yeah, exactly. That, I don't know. I think when you come from a slightly tougher physical environment, such as that down under, maybe you're a little more sanguine about this stuff, to use an unfortunate term.
I think you're right.
All right. I am going to watch a couple more episodes of The Deadliest Decade, and I'm going to range around in their, you know, 90s archive as well. This one was like just like a C plus B minus for me, but I would like to see what they do with other episodes. Any recommendations on that tip?
Yeah, I was pretty interested. There's one called The Milk Carton Murder, which is an exaggerated title because it's about a murder that happened to happen around the same time and in the same area of the country where the first, you know, child abduction that ended up on advertised on a milk carton in 1984 happened. But that particular episode is done very well. And it sort of avoids, you know, being at pains to create a link between the time and the crime.
Very good. Speaking of links, it's the Bolo section. Kevin, where can listeners find you and your work right now?
You can find me on Twitter at WeeGee, on the old fashioned web at Kevin Smokler, SMOKLER.com. And my new book is called Brat Pack America, A Love Letter to 80s Teen Movies.
And there's no mistaking which one it is. God bless that silhouette of Bender. It's a fantastic, fantastic cover. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us again.
Oh, you're welcome, sir. It was great to be here. Thanks.
Next time on The Blotter Presents, Toby Ball returns to talk about approximately 7 million Waco projects and also the 70s documentary Marjo. You can find me on Twitter at Sarah D. Bunting. You knew that. You can find me on Twitter at Tomato Nation. You can find this podcast on Twitter and Facebook at Blotter Presents. And you can discuss everything that we've talked about today and more on our forums at previously.tv/forums. Talk to you next time.
In a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.